This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Hymnus ad Patrum Sinensis by Philip Whalen. I praise those ancient Chinamen who left me a few words, usually a pointless joke or a silly question, a line of poetry drunkenly scrawled on the margin of a quick splashed picture, bug, leaf, caricature of teacher, on paper held together now by little more than ink and their own strength brushed momentarily over it. Their world in several sense gone to hell in a handbasket. They knew it, cheered as it whizzed by, and conked out among the busted spring rain cherry blossom wine jars, happy to have saved us all. I think many people consider this Whalen's best poem, perhaps because it's his most straightforward and accessible. In a way, it's not that characteristic of his style. If Frank O'Hara's poetry was characterized by I did this, I did that, Whalen's is, I thought this, I thought that. He said his poetry was a record or a picture of a mind moving. And so a typical Whalen poem is more often a kind of free association on a theme, and you see a kind of quirky mind moving back and forth around some picture. This one, though, seems more traditionally structured. It's dated August 31st, 1958. So it's written for Whalen at a relatively early period in his life, before he went to Japan, before he moved into San Francisco Zen Center and became a monk. This dates from the days of not so long after the famous Gallery 6 reading in San Francisco in 1955, where Allen Ginsberg first read Howl. And Gary Snyder and Philip Whalen were also part of that the program and part of that scene. 5 years after it was written, one of Whalen's small press publisher friends, Don Allen, asked him to copy out the poem in his own handwriting for him and printed the broadside you see in the hall. By the time that was printed, Whalen was just about 40 years old. About more than half of his life was over. And he had, you know, big collection of unpublished and unpublishable poems that were finally collected in this book on Bear's Head in 1969. He was then about 46, I think. And it would have been a great triumph to have his collected poems put together this way. But the publisher had no confidence in it and priced this hardcover at $17.50, which made it virtually unaffordable to anybody. And I think it sank without much notice. In any case, one of the reasons I'm reading this today is I think that it presents a kind of whimsical and joyful picture of practice, both meditation practice and poetry practice. And Whalen's style of writing, simply watching and recording the movement of his mind, he did because he found his mind really, really interesting. And both poetry and meditation were ways of paying attention to this interesting mind, right? As it moves and does all sorts of quirky, unexpected things. Things that if you just leave it alone and watch it, have a much bigger range than our usual kinds of logical everyday thinking. It represents a time when people studied Zen out of fascination with the possibilities of the mind. There was a way in which certainly Snyder and Whalen and many of those generation were interested in Japanese and Chinese culture, in some ways the way they were interested in American Indian anthropology and folklore. They were interested in the big range of human possibility, what it meant in different times and different cultures to be a human and to seek wisdom, to create art, to find meaning. And I think that when I started reading about Zen and practicing it sort of towards the end of the 60s, I must have been just starting high school when this Don Allen printed this broadside, but by the end of the 60s I was starting to read some of these guys. And I was reading psychoanalysis in largely the same spirit, that the mind was really complicated and interesting. And we read psychoanalysis then the way we practiced a countercultural politics, looking at a different way of seeing things, seeing different possibilities of living. Trying to open up a sense of possibilities. See, I think all this study sort of came from a perspective that the mind and the way to live throughout history and across culture came in enormous a number of fascinating, interesting varieties, but probably the single dullest one ever devised was that of a middle-class white male in America in the 1950s. You couldn't find a kind of more constipated and boring culture then. It's sort of the way people felt, and they wanted to expand it, right, in every possible kind of direction. And they did it with a sense of exploration and excitement and sometimes revolution. Now, the simple joy and whimsy of this poem is the sort of thing that I sometimes think Joko Beck made it her mission to wipe out in Zen. And I sometimes blame her for making Zen not fun anymore. Joko would say that you shouldn't do this practice unless you have to. You know, she sort of thought it as what you do when all your attempts to evade yourself and distract yourself and fool yourself. They've exhausted themselves and run out, and you've got nothing to do but to sit there and be honest and look in the mirror and say, this is me, and finally sort of deconstruct what the hell that meant. She thought the mind was perhaps repetitive and tricky and organized around kinds of repetitive defensive patterns that kept us imprisoned in their sort of narrow framework. Right? The mind was less fascinating than it was a kind of problem to be solved or a prison to be broken out of. Now, she came by this point of view honestly. I mean, she saw how a lot of people who had started practicing and wanted the excitement and wanted the highs and wanted the big Kensho experiences, how all those things distracted them or colluded with their desire simply to escape how screwed up their lives were in other personal dimensions. She wasn't wrong about that. And yet, somehow, I think we have to find a balance between these two perspectives. Joko said, don't do this unless you have to. Equally, I would probably say, don't do this.